Senate Committee on Finance will come to order. Today is Thursday, January 20th, 2011. And we are going to start off where we left off last week in our budget overview. And we will be having Eric Naumann continue the presentation. I think he's got a few slides just for a quick review, and then we're moving into the education and health and human services areas of the budget. Mr. Naumann.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Eric Naumann. I'm the fiscal analyst for the K-12 or Education Committee, and I've served in that role for about 14 sessions. And as the chair mentioned, I've reinserted a couple of charts out of order from your packet just as a reminder of where we were as we begin to drill down into the larger of the two budget areas that are on the table for your discussion. So we're just calling this the Education, Health, and Human Services focus to the briefing from last week. So we begin with a look at the all funds, and what I'd like you to take a look through is simply the size of education and human services. That's why we're giving you a particular focus on these areas, because they are the two largest budget areas, both in the all funds as well as the general fund. So you see that education is 27% of the all funds area, and human services is 41.4%. That relationship, as Mr. Mossman mentioned last week, flips when you begin to look straight down to the general fund. Education now has popped up to about 40.5% and 30.8%. That education number is a little artificially high as a result of the statutory requirement that the shifts be paid back. And we'll talk about that in a little bit later. But it's still larger than human services. Are there questions on those? That was sort of our quick review to set the table from what we talked about last week.
And Mr. Naumann, the reason it shifts or flips over when we just go to general fund is because all of the federal funding that comes in for human services. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. When we get into some of the detail, it'll be real clear that education is largely a general fund conversation, whereas human services has vastly larger percentage of federal funds and other funds than education does. Which brings us, frankly, to our next chart. So now we're looking at just the education portion and confining the conversation to all funds. So you can see that education, that's about 90% of the pie there, is general fund. So the vast majority of the education spending is, in fact, general funds. The federal money, special education, and some pass-through grants, the No Child Left Behind program, mostly passed directly to school districts, although there's a number of employees that are funded at the Department of Education on federal funds. The Permanent School Trust Fund, we truncated that name, is funding that's dedicated by Constitution, and it's dollars sent directly to school districts on a per-pupil basis. Are there questions? Now we're looking just at that 90% of the all funds and confining it to the traditional areas of that the Education Committee has looked at with respect. So divided the pieces up into the big pots. General education is by far the largest piece. That constitutes about 81%. And I'll talk about the general education program in a moment. The education programs are smaller grant programs by and large. This also includes things like charter school lease aid, integration aid, and small grant programs that the legislature in years past has chosen to fund. So they're important programs to a variety of individuals, but it's and in many cases we spend a fair amount of time in the education committee talking about those individual programs. But you can see in terms of percentages, it's a relatively small piece of the pie. Special education, by contrast, is the next largest to the general education program. And, Madam Chair, I know you've had an interest in talking about growth factors. And there is a growth factor of 4.6% on part of this and 2.6% applied to another portion of it. So the appropriation does grow year to year. And in past years, the legislature has taken a look at, has added those growth factors to recognize the increased cost of special education as it grows year to year.
Mr. Nauman, is that mainly because of an increase in the number of students in special education, or is it mainly because of the costs increasing?
Madam Chair, it's a little bit of both, but I would suggest it's probably mostly increasing costs associated with students. Special education services are notoriously very expensive.
So, Mr. Nauman, how does that differ than being considered inflation?
Well, in some respects it is, Madam Chair, an inflationary adjustment. And what's different about special education relative to other portions of the education budget is that there's a federal mandate that education or special education services be provided. And this was a law passed by Congress back in the early 70s. And some people believe that Congress committed to providing 40%, which it's never done. So then the balance of those funds have to come from state and local. Minnesota has chosen to put dollars on the table in the form of state aid to help pay for special education costs. But that, too, doesn't comprise – we don't fully fund our formula. So the balance comes from the local side of things. So as costs increase, this sort of implicit deal, federal, state, local, the legislature in years past has chosen to increase dollars each year. But to be frank, in the early 2000s, I believe it was Governor Pawlenty's first year, those growth factors were turned off. And that helped create short-term budget savings, but it did put more pressure on general education dollars because in order for those costs to be provided, as they were mandated by federal law, local districts had to transfer general education dollars to pay for that increased special education cost.
Mr. Nauman, but a few years ago, did we not increase the state contribution again?
Madam Chair, you're certainly correct. I think that was in the 2007 session. What the legislature did was reinstate the growth factors. So that as we go back in history, we turned them off in 2003 session and kept the special education appropriation static. Then beginning in 2007, we had an increased adjustment, and then each year subsequent to that, there's been a gradual ratcheting upwards of the appropriation for the reasons that I just stated.
Mr. Nauman, with the cross subsidy, how has the percent been increasing? Have the districts been reporting that, or has with the growth factor in place, have they been keeping up approximately the same as when we initiated in 2007?
Madam Chair, say a little bit more. You mean have they kept up with?
Well, I know that they're having growth in special education costs, and I know that the districts, if we don't contribute a certain percent, then they cross-subsidize from their general fund dollars. And so I'm just wondering, has that stabilized since 2007?
Well, I think what the data will show you, and we're on top of receiving from the department the most recent cross-subsidy report. I think it comes out mid-January or the end of January that gives us a new look at where the cross-subsidy is. The cross-subsidy certainly, for members' information, what we're talking about is the amount that school districts have to cross-subsidize from their general fund to pay for the cost of special ed after you make some adjustments. So it's a measurement of how much general education dollars are bled off to pay for the special ed costs, which are mandated by federal law. Those are continuing to increase, primarily because special education costs are increasing at a rate faster than the increased dollars that we're putting in on the state side.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Nauman, is that a factor of the solely of the actual costs or also increased special ed population?
Madam Chair, both. And Madam Chair, it's a factor of both.
Okay.
I think that it's more cost than, I think there's a real issue for the legislature to think about if there's ways to work on cost containment on special education. The population is increasing, but not at the rate that that would be the primary cost driver.
Senator Newman?
Madam Chair, thank you. Two different growth factors are being discussed here. One's 4.6, one is 2%. Could you explain to me, you know,
sure,
what they are? I mean, are we talking a total of 6.6, or you've lost?
No, they're not additive. I realize I kind of glossed over that, Senator, and I apologize for that. I was trying to simplify the conversation. There are two primary education, special education programs. One is the regular special education program, and that has a growth factor of 4.6% each year. Then there's the what's called the excess cost special education program, and that one is designed to, in some cases, there are school districts that have extreme special ed costs, and that program kicks in for those districts. So there's far fewer districts that are receiving the excess cost, and that one escalates at 2%.
Senator Newman, I'm sorry.
Use your mic.
the total cost of special ed increasing on an annual basis is 6.6% per year.
Madam Chair and Senator, no, I would not add those $2 together. Those two percentages together. It would be actually more, the total base of the regular special education is a much higher number, first, than excess cost. So what you're doing is you're increasing those two programs at their various percentages each year. So in actuality, the growth is probably, in percentage terms, is probably more like the 3%, somewhere in that range. We could certainly calculate that delta for you.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, Senator Newman, that excess cost is often driven by some, a school district might have one individual that is a very high cost to serve, and you know that isn't equate, and that's why it's treated differently, and that's where that excess cost usually kicks in.
Mr. Nauman, when the federal stimulus money became available for special education, and we knew it would be one-time money, what was it typically used for? And it had to help somewhat last year.
Madam Chair, I think if you're talking about the federal ERA money, I've got a slide that
okay.
discusses that in the future, but it doesn't go actually into the detail of what we used it for. So what I can speak to is what we used it for was general education dollars. It was $500 million that, in a sense, allowed us to appropriate a lower amount than we normally would have to balance the bill. So if you visualize that if I owe you $10, I actually give you $9, and then the federal government is giving you the extra dollar. So we didn't change the overall program. It just allowed us to appropriate state aid at a lower amount. And so what it did was it was a mix to the extent that general education dollars are cross-subsidized to special education, and that certainly happens. Those dollars help pay for special ed, but it was really slotted for general education.
Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman, wasn't there, I recall, also some additional dollars that districts could apply for with regard to special ed, and most chose not to because they were afraid of the maintenance of effort?
Well, there were some fairly complicated maintenance of effort. Yes, those are separate dollars that flowed directly out of the ERA bill to school districts.
Madam Chair, I think that's probably what you were wondering about, and I don't think most of them chose to use it because they were concerned that then they would have had to continue spending those dollars and they wouldn't have had them.
Okay. Senator Gooden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nauman, I wonder if there's been any analysis done on how much education has ended up subsidizing services that would otherwise be considered health and human services.
Mr. Nauman?
For example, mental health issues and maybe some physical health issues and so forth.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, During my tenure, I can think of only some tangential analyses that have occurred on that, but we can certainly look into that and get back to you on that. I'll make a point of doing that. If I can find my pen and make a note. Okay. Are there other questions on this slide before I move on? Okay. this is good. I know that when we first did this presentation, we were worried that education was going to get so truncated that you wouldn't be able to have a conversation. So I'm glad that it worked out this way. We can spend a little bit more time. For the folks that are really interested in numbers, I'll flip back between these two slides so you can see the colors. The colors on this is going to work a lot better on the color slides than they will in black and white. But as you think through this, the colors here correlate to the categories here. So the top two blue lines, and this is a sort of a truncated version of the K-12 spreadsheet in the big categories. Special education is just that one line. I mentioned the pink education excellence programs or education programs. That's the education excellence line, facilities and technology, that primarily debt service for school districts that have taken out debt service equalization, rather. The nutrition lines, and then what we call the early accounts. It's not just early ed accounts. It's also adult education. That's sort of the truncated word that we use to talk about it. And sometimes it's a little bit confusing. The education agencies of the Department of Education, the Purpich School, and the Faribault Academies are also appropriated out of the education committee. So it's not all in the state agencies. So sometimes there's some confusion that the state agencies committee deals with all of the education agencies. The education department and a couple other schools are dealt with by our committee. One of the interesting factors that I'd like you to look at that I want to come back to is that very top line, the general education program. These dollars are appropriated dollars. So what we actually put in the bill. notice that in fiscal 2010, the general education program was 4.2. It then increases to 4.8 in 2011. Then a big increase in 6.7. And in 2013, it settles back to 5.7. Brownie points for anyone that can tell me why.
We're all wondering, Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Oh. That first jump is the loss of the federal era money.
Yeah.
But some of it will be also the growth of student growth, I would presume.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I'll give you half points for that because that's a partial answer.
Senator Vana?
Madam Chair, Mr. Nauman, and we have booked that we're going to pay back the shift.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it's the combination
of
those.
I've already done that. I've paid back.
Yeah,
yes.
You've already paid it back.
No, not paid back. Extended it.
Oh, I see.
It's made it permanent.
Okay. That's exactly right. And I've got a couple of charts, Madam Chair, that'll go into that. But I wanted to at least isolate it here so you have in your brain what that relationship is. Okay. Any other questions before I move on?
Mr. Nauman, is the same thing true for special education, why that's going up so
Madam
much?
Madam Chair, it's exactly right. And in fact, you'll actually see it in most of the line items. There is some shift. I highlight general education because that's exactly where the ERA money is. And that's also the line item that the property tax recognition shift affects. So when we get into subsequent slides, I'm going to isolate that conversation so you can see the effect of all of them together. But absolutely, the payment shift affects debt service. So you can see it in the facilities and technology line. It affects the charter school lease aid. So you can see it in the education excellence line. It affects some of the early childhood accounts, school readiness, for example. So you can see it there. So the payment shift is littered throughout the education spreadsheet, which makes it real hard to kind of isolate what the actual patterns are in terms of spending. So I got a slide that tries to unpack some of that. Education is also a unique budget jurisdiction because it also has property tax jurisdiction. And many of the accounts, there's actually a four-page spreadsheet that once the Finance Committee is done with, if there's an omnibus K-12 bill, once we're done in the Finance Committee, we have to make a stop in the Tax Committee. There's this sort of what I would call healthy tension between the spending side of education and the desire to control the property taxes. We have formulas that are often a blend of state aid and property taxes. And there's a desire to, in many cases, to fully fund education, if you will, whatever that means to you. and that can be done with a couple of levers. It can be done with state aid, dollars that we appropriate, or you could expand the levy authority. And the Tax Committee usually tends to look pretty closely at what is done in the education bill on the tax side. So we also produce a spreadsheet that shows the actual tax expenditures on the property tax side. This is a high-level summary version of that. You can see most of it is in the general fund. There's some small community service and debt service funds. OPEB, it relates to GASB 45, which is a new government accounting regulation that requires school districts to carry levies associated with future pension, future retirement benefits on their books, and we have a fund for that. So the total levies are shown here for the last three years.
Senator Hand.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Mr. Nauman, could you talk a little bit about in 2011 that OPEB line and the significant increase? You mentioned the GASB change, but maybe for the benefit of members, you could talk a little about what that
is. It is a significant increase, Senator, and I would suggest primarily it's because it's a brand new authority. And I think that fiscal year 10 was the first year it came online. So what you're seeing is school districts that were required under the new accounting regulations to begin recognizing these liabilities on their books. The legislature provided this levy in part to pay for that, to help them carry the costs of that liability. And some of them came online in different sequencing patterns. So the percentage growth is looks substantial, but when you recognize that it's a relatively new authority, that helps explain it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, you know, that was a provision that was passed in the Tax Committee that never came to education. It was a great surprise when school districts were going out and bonding for that obligation. And I think the change that was made, and I don't know when that will start to reflect, of allowing them to go ahead with that bonding, but only if they shut off the pipeline. They had no further that pensions for health care or health insurance could not be included in their collective bargaining going forward. So do you have any projection as to how long that's going to continue, whether that's the growth mode, if 60 million the peak, and then it'll start diminishing, or what are there? Is it covering everybody that is approaching retirement that was under contract at that time, so that it's going to go on for many years?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, your description of the details is spot on. In terms of projection, I'm quickly digging for, we project levies out through the same projection period as the budget. So the OPEB calculations are flat. They go to 60.2 in fiscal 15. And beyond that, we don't have projections beyond that. But I would anticipate it probably would grow at a fairly steady pace. One of the changes that was made during that period that you talked about is districts are also allowed to do pay-as-you-go. And depending on how, in other words, they're levying for the exact amount that they need as opposed to taking out bonds on the front end.
So Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman, this is not a general fund impact at this point, is it?
Madam Chair and members, none of these dollars relate directly to your $6.2 billion shortfall.
None of which?
None of these dollars on this page. This is only the levy side of things.
Okay.
It's coincidentally called the general fund because it primarily, these are general fund levies as opposed to community service levies. But this doesn't relate to your budget shortfall that you're addressing.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nauman, just going back to that OPEB line, and the recollection I have is that there was a change a few years ago that required school districts to at least recognize the amount of liability that they had accumulated in making promises to pay for retirement and other benefits to employees. And this, as I understand it, is a way to allow school districts to begin to show some sort of asset to play off against that liability. But that liability is pretty significant. Do you have any information about what school districts in total are looking at in terms of these, at one point were not even noticed, but obligations that we have to pay? Is that something that can be, I know this doesn't affect our general fund or our deficit problem, so-called, but it's a significant issue, and I think it relates to other pension issues that we have in the state and how we're going to finance those going forward.
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, it's a great question, and I think probably maybe I'm going to put words in your mouth, and you tell me if I'm going the right direction. It probably would be useful to know what it was before, what the unfunded amount was before this resource was put in place. And are you also interested in looking at cities and counties, because OPEB did relate to them as well? This is just the school district piece of that.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman, yes, and partly to see what effect that is having on the growth of the liability, if we're making progress against that or not, and just what the magnitude of that obligation is. I think these long-term pension obligations that we assume at different levels of government, I think, are potentially a landmine waiting for us, and they should be recognized. And for a long time, they were not even on the radar. And now that they are, we should pay some attention to it.
I think let me take a little time and crawl into that, and I can feedback either to the full committee or to you directly.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, I share your interest in this because we did not really go through this in the Education Committee, so I don't have much information about it on a district basis. I'd be interested in looking at it in terms of the runs and then also having some sense of what the impact is on the property taxes and understanding what kind of an average per household based on cost of house we're talking about in terms of this liability. I think it's important because as we look at the overall property tax burden, that it's important for us as a committee to understand what makes up some of that property tax burden.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, obviously what you've laid out is a very complicated question.
I know.
You may very quickly begin to feel like the Pension Commission in some of this, so be careful.
Okay.
But I will certainly take an initial shot at it and see what we have available in terms of data and get back to the committee.
Follow up.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, I'm assuming this is not a voter-approved levy.
Madam Chair, no.
Okay.
Madam Chair? Just to follow up on that, Senator Madam Chair, Eric, why don't you get the Pension Committee staff to do it for you?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, you've discovered some of our cheats.
Senator Meg.
I think we'll see what the department has in terms of UFAR's data, and then we'll proceed from there.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To get off of pensions for a minute, going back up to debt service fund, I see a $50 million increase there. Could you talk a little bit about that? And are you forecasting any? How do interest rates factor into this? And maybe you can give us a little longer term projection. Are you showing any potential increases in your forecast on debt service, or is this just stable interest rates on bonds and so on, or what is that?
Madam Chair and Senator Magnus, if you give me just a quick moment here, it does. I'm just looking at some of the detail. The for this to break these numbers out a little bit, the debt service portion of that 763 in fiscal 10 is $698 million. Okay. And it grows to $750.5 million in fiscal year 13. So that's that portion of the 808. Through, if you project that out through 15, it goes to $773 million. So it is by far that there's a few other debt service-related line items, but it is the primary driver. I personally am not doing the forecast on the levies. We're accepting the department's analysis on this unless we make legislative adjustments and then the legislature would make a change to it. What I can speculate is that what the department is assuming is that there are, based on historical patterns, school districts will be increasing debt to pay for the cost of a construction program.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus,
just to throw out a note of caution, we may see interest rates increase since they can't hardly decrease anything when almost at zero now. So just a word of caution in some of that stuff. If we're seeing large increases without taking potential interest increases in there, it could have a real train wreck.
And another factor that was that I thought was particularly interesting in the last election on the school district side of things, everything else that happened got a lot more attention, but as it affects this committee's general fund, on the education side of things, we had booked what's called the property tax recognition shift savings associated with early recognizing levies. And we had made an assumption, the department and legislative staff in conjunction, about what the size of that property tax recognition shift would be. And it was based in part on what we thought the levy passage rate, mostly operating levies, would be. And it ended up being smaller. And so what you have is a pressure going the other direction. Potentially the interest rate's a good conversation, but if people are feeling property tax sensitive, they may push the no button more than they push the yes button, which would tend to drive that line down as well.
Yeah.
So you've got countervailing pressures. And on the operating side, what that meant was $50 million of increased cost to the education spending in 12 rather than in the current biennium, rather than what we had originally assumed. Okay, that was fun. We move from levies, and remember that top line, general education, and these are appropriated dollars. We skip past the levies, and now, and I also have a sheet in front of you here that's gonna relate to this conversation too. And I'll come to that in a second, but first the graphics. If you look at what in education parlance we call the aid entitlements, this is just the general education program. So the basic formula allowance, compensatory, referendum, alternative compensation, sometimes called QComp, equity, operating capital, transportation sparsity. These are all the programs that the legislature has enacted formulas, if you will, to pass dollars directly to school districts. And the point of this slide is to just have you see on a relative basis, the size of the basic formula allowance. And that's our most simple program, but it's our biggest. It's the legislature establishes a formula allowance, and we multiply it times the kids. And we result in a $4.8 or so billion-dollar appropriation. And so when we talk about, in drilling down on the various slides, education has a very small portion of federal funds and other funds and a really large portion of general fund. Of the general fund, the largest portion is the general education program. And of the general education program, the largest piece by far, over 80%, is in fact the basic formula. So that's what I'm hoping you take away from this. I will also point out that these dollars represented here are before any shifts. So these are aid entitlements, directly what the programs produce in a given year. And as members that have sat through a few legislative sessions, you know that the aid shift changes the sequence when a given year's formulas are actually sent directly to districts. Currently, we're operating on a 70-30% shift, which means that this year's formulas generate 70% on the appropriation, and the lagging payment, because last year's shift was a different number, is 27%. So you add those two numbers together, and in real simple terms, that generates your appropriation. Did I lose you? Okay.
That happened long ago.
That long history. And this spreadsheet here is something that we use in the education committee. It may be something that just the fiscal staff is interested in, but I'd like to think that members find it useful, because what it allows you to do is isolate the effect of any changes in general education. Here we're just showing November forecast over November forecast, but it's our setup for what we're going to be doing throughout the session. So if a change is made to general education, you can isolate that change relative to what the shift is doing. So these two pieces are going to be moving in different directions, I suspect. And this will allow you to say, oh, we took $2 off the formula. Let's see where that $100 million shows up. And it's on this sheet that it would show up. But, of course, you'd only recognize 70% of it.
Mr. Nauman, as I was looking at this sheet, and there's two things for sparsity. One is transportation sparsity, and one is sparsity. Could you help me understand the difference? I mean, I understand what transportation sparsity would be for, but what about the other?
Well, transportation sparsity, based on its sound, sounds like it's transportation dollars that schools have to use for transportation. And in part, that's true, but it's not required to be spent on transportation. It's a formula that recognizes, and it was created after the old transportation formula, I think in 1995. Mr. Mesakanis is in the room. He can correct me because he was doing the accounts then, if I got that wrong. But I think it was 1995 when we rolled the old transportation formula into the basic formula allowance, and we created the transportation sparsity formula in part as part of that construction. The sparsity formula, by contrast, is designed to recognize the costs, the increased cost, perceived or otherwise, of operating a school district that has very, very few kids per square mile. And it keys, there's two pieces to it. There's an elementary sparsity and a secondary sparsity based on the distance between a high school in one district relative to the next nearest high school. It also uses some calculations to measure the amount of kids per square mile. It's a relatively small piece of the pie, but it matters. The districts that receive it will tell you it matters a great deal to them.
Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nauman, just I imagine somewhere in one of these categories, but the formula aid, or the aid that comes through that we call the integration formula, integration aid, that there's been some discussion about and reporting on, where does that accounted for in these
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, the integration aid is in the education excellence line. It's not in the general education program. So what we've done is drilled down sort of past it. I'm digging for my spreadsheet to tell you. I think it's about $100 million aid and levy program. It's about 7% aid and 30% levy. And
so, Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman, so in your line of education excellence showing about $150 million, about, what, two-thirds of that is the integration?
Yes. In fiscal year 11, the November forecast, again, this is a shifted program, so it's going to be skewed by the shifts as well, was $61.3 million. In 12 and 13, it's 79 and 67, respectively. Good question, because that's one of the big line items that that is buried in that specific one. Okay, so there, that's the general education program, and again, we drilled down to, you can see the pieces. If you want to look at the exact numbers, these numbers correlate to the sheet that I handed out. But on the sheet, you can see that, I'll just mention this briefly, the aid, the levy, and the total. So the aid columns are what we actually appropriate in the bill. The levy columns are what we would end up carrying on the levy spreadsheet and the, would be part of the tax committee jurisdiction. Districts primarily care about what's in the far right-hand column, how much cash they have to spend, the revenue. Okay. Remember this chart? Mr. Mossman briefed this chart last year. And I'm down to my last few charts here, and we'll kick it to Human Services. But this was his attempt to unpack the 27.5% spending difference between the two fiscal years. And you can see that he mentions up at the top the education shift, the era on the FMAP, and the education payment shift, and the era of fiscal stabilization. A good portion of that is an education conversation, as I mentioned earlier. And what I'd like to do is to just take the general education portion of the appropriation and unpack it again so that you can see the pieces and how they stack together. So this is what we have appropriated in the forecast for the various biennia. So fiscal 10 to 11, 12 and 13, 14, 15. We have 9.1 in 10, and then there's a sizable jump in fiscal 12 and 13, and then it settles back down in 14 and 15. And my little question earlier was designed to sort of get at that. What's going on? Is it, did we really have that many pupil growth? And the answer, of course, is no. We did have pupil growth, but that's not the primary driver of why the appropriations are different. And this is the same data. We start with the same numbers, but you can see the age shift on the left side, and again, that's not, you'll ask me, isn't it 1.4? And the answer is yes, but we're just looking at the general education program. So the age shift moves 1.1 from fiscal year 10 into fiscal year 12. The software required me to show it as a negative number underneath, but if you can visualize it, that would pull the 12-13 number downward, and it would pump up the 10 and 11 number. So it's a transfer from one biennium to the next. The property tax recognition shift does two things. It changes when school districts recognize property tax revenue from an October time frame into a May time frame. And what that means is that school districts are getting new money. And then we create savings in about $519 million by pulling out that on a one-time basis, general education dollars that are appropriated. So that created a reduction in general education spending. And then finally, as we talked about before, there's the federal era money. It was one-time money that allowed us, that essentially made our formulas cheaper. So that's how those pieces stack together. And I'll mention quickly, there's a little green line on the top of the next two, and that's because as property taxes grow, there's a little bit of extra slop, if you will, from your of early recognition.
Mr. Nowen, is the federal stimulus money, is that the 519? Which one is it?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. It's probably hard to see on your copy. If you look at the screen, I think it's a little bit easier. The top purple, the 500 is the federal era money. The 519 is the property tax recognition shift. That's what PTRS is. Mr. Mossman asked me last week, what's PTRS? And I said, oh, that's an acronym. He said, oh, yeah, of course. And then there's the age shift. That's the 1.1.
Okay, thank you.
So with that as background, this is my last chart, and then we'll do Human Services. If we hadn't done any of those budget shifts.
Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, sorry. When you said this just dealt with general ed appropriation, were you meaning that it does not take into account the shift associated with the levy side?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonham, no. What I was trying to do was just isolate the general education conversation to just the general education program. So it could get very complicated if we introduced other appropriated lines on the payment shift. What I'm mostly saying to you is, if you have burned in your head that the cost of the payment shift, extending it, saves 1.4, it does.
Right.
But what I'm showing here is 1.1 because all the other line items that are shifted, the special education, the charter school,
gotcha.
Those are not part of this, so that's why that number is different.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so then if you then show what the education appropriations would have been without the federal era money, without the shifts, this is what the picture looks like. So the darker column on the left is our starting point. After you make the adjustments, here's what the appropriations are. So this would have been. This allows you to see what the budget machinations and the fixes did to education. So really our spending should have been in 10 and 11, 11.2, and now you can see the comparison between biennia. So sure, there is growth in education, but it goes from 11.2 to 11.5 to 11.9, and I'm hoping that's helpful.
Thank you. That is helpful.
Are there other questions before we move to human services? Before we do, I'll mention that we have planned, beginning tomorrow, a more detailed, if your appetite's whetted for education, more detailed education finance briefing. Senator Fischbach's laughing at me.
I'm laughing with you.
We do an education finance briefing that goes into more detail on all the various programs. In some years, we've done this in an intimate setting in a committee room that's that just with a collection of members, and that's what we're doing this year. In some years, in more recent past, we've done it in a briefing format, the way we're doing here. We're going to be doing that over. We have three scheduled next week, and our first one's next Friday, or this Friday.
All right.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nalvin. And now we're going to do the Health and Human Services portion of the budget, which is also a very large portion. And Dennis Albrecht is going to guide us through this one.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think after Eric's presentation, this will seem very simple. I thought my area was complex, but apparently complexity is something that can be of orders of magnitude. This first sheet for the Health and Human Services Budget Committee shows you the agencies in state government that are under the jurisdiction of this committee. It does represent about 31% of all general fund spending, in case you don't remember that from the earlier slides. By far the largest agency in this committee's jurisdiction is the Department of Human Services, and you'll see later that is the agency that constitutes about 95% of the general fund spending in this area. This is the all funds allocation for Health and Human Services. I think what you would want to pay attention to on this slide is the general fund proportion being 43.5% of the money in this committee's jurisdiction, and an even larger percentage coming from the federal fund, $12.1 billion, or 45.4% of the money. The reason for that significant portion coming from the federal fund is primarily the MA program. That's where the federal portion of funding for that program shows up. Another large component of that would be the food stamp program, or what's now known as the SNAP program. And then you can see that the other funds are proportionately smaller. Perhaps the one that will receive some attention this year that you might hear about is the Healthcare Access Fund, and that's about $1.4 billion. This slide shows you for the entire budget jurisdiction just how the general fund is allocated among the various agencies. And as I indicated earlier, you'll see that by far the largest is the Department of Human Services. It's about $11 billion, or 95% of the general fund spending in this area. One thing you might be interested in is the slice up there at the top, the MA expansion contingency. That is the amount of money in the forecast for that contingent, what was at the time a contingent appropriation, and now the governor has issued an executive order, I guess, invoking that contingency. So that's now real spending of $384 million in the general fund.
Mr. Albrecht, if I know there's been some discussion about when that program would be implemented, and does the dollar amount change accordingly, whether or not it's implemented shortly, or if it takes until October, what impact does that have on it?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the amount that's in the forecast, the $384 million, assumed a January 1st implementation date. My understanding currently is that the department, at the governor's direction, has been asked to implement it on March 1st. So the actual spending in this biennium will change, but this amount here is for the 12-13 biennium, so it's unlikely to change very much if indeed it can be implemented before June 30th.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
And Mr. Albrecht, just to clarify that, if I know there were projections about this program not being implementable just practically until October, and I know that's being debated, and I know the governor would like to see it earlier, but if that is in fact the case, then this number would be affected in that there would be reductions reflecting non-use of the money from July till whenever it did come on stream. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, that's correct. So after next, we're going to move into the various departments in this committee's jurisdiction. And so this is showing you for the Department of Human Services only how the general fund allocations in that department are allocated among the major spending areas in the department. I think what's important to note or to look at are the largest pieces there, the 47% for basic health care and the 33% for continuing care. Continuing care is where spending on the elderly and disabled shows up. Those are both MA spending components. If you take those along with the 3% for the MA expansion, those constitute 83% of the spending in the Department of Human Services.
Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, Mr. Albrecht, where does the money that we're getting, the match for the early enrollment, as well as the money that would be coming to Minnesota as a result of that, where does that get reflected? Is that because that goes directly to the providers? Do we not reflect that anywhere in your chart?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, that money shows up in the federal fund, and the way that it is accounted for in this committee is that the federal money reduces the state appropriation, the state general fund appropriation. So for every dollar of spending for services and on health care, the state cost is 50 cents, and that's what shows up in all of these numbers. So, for example, I was just going to say that the MA program is an $8.7 billion general fund spending program, but there is an equal amount of money that comes from the federal government, so it's really, you know, like a $17 billion program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Albrecht, and to that point, and the converse of that, of course, and because of the large percentage of programs in this budget area that have federal matching funds, if we reduce the the budget, if we look at taking money from the state portion of the funds, it results in a $2 reduction in spending overall. For every one of the dollars that we take out of these programs that have a federal match, then we lose an additional dollar. So that to me represents one of the challenges here. If we're going to cut significant money from the Health and Human Services budget, whatever the dollar amount we take out of the general fund is going to be matched by a loss on the federal money, assuming we can do it, which there are constraints to impede that. Is that correct, Mr. Ulbrich?
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, that is correct.
Mr. Ulbrich, we have a federal maintenance of effort requirement now for a number of the health care programs. As we look at these right here, are all of these included, or are there some that would not be included in that?
Madam Chair, the 83% of the budget that I mentioned that is the MA program is affected by MOE requirements. But it doesn't mean that the state can't reduce spending in this area. The requirement relates to eligibility. So the state cannot reduce spending by limiting or restricting eligibility. But there are a number of other things, provider payment reductions primarily, placing limits on some of the waiver spending. In fact, there are currently limits in place for those waivers. Those sorts of changes can be done under the MOE requirements.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Just to follow up on your question then, Mr. Ulbrich. So with the MOE requirements, if it's a program not impacted by federal law and monies, we could eliminate that. We could do whatever we wanted. So if it was a question of payments to doctors, for instance, that's what you mentioned about in terms of provider payments. So that's not an element controlled by federal law. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, it is not controlled by federal law, and it is not affected by the MOE requirements. My understanding, though, is that there are federal requirements that the state not, for example, reduce payment rates so much that providers would not accept MA clients.
Okay. So Madam Chair, one of the things, and this obviously I don't serve on Senator Hahn's division or committee, so I don't get first crack at it, but to the extent that this legislation comes in front of this committee, what will be useful is to make sure we understand what's eligible for reduction, and not so much for people on the division or the committee, but for the rest of us, to understand what is eligible for reduction. I assume, for instance, there are no MOE requirements in terms of the general fund budget. There are no MOE requirements for nursing homes, as an example, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, there would be requirements to the extent that you couldn't cut a population that is eligible to be in a nursing home.
Okay.
You could cut the rates that you pay the nursing home, but you couldn't cut a person out of being able to be in a nursing home.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, that's why I think it's going to be important for all of us to have a better appreciation, given the deficit, as to what's eligible, what's not eligible. So I appreciate your offering that distinction, that within nursing home payments, you can't cut payments that would affect somebody's eligibility, but if you wanted to cut rate payments to the nursing home operators directly, you could eliminate that program in its entirety, I'm assuming.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, I don't think that you could go that far.
Okay.
My understanding in my discussions with folks from the Department of Human Services is that you can't make rate changes that have the result that services are available to MA recipients at a different level than they would be to members of the general population.
Okay. Well, and Madam Chair, if I can just continue this, that's why, so I offered a hypothetical and you immediately said, no, my hypothetical wasn't correct. And that's why I think it's going to be important for us to understand where these distinctions are and possibly even, I don't know, direct it to the two chairs, I don't know if we ought to have some kind of just separate, I won't suggest what a hearing ought to be, but maybe just something written out of, from your office, from yourself or your office, relative to what can be done, what cannot be done. Because my fear is that, we've looked at these things before, but I think given where we are this year and kind of the enormity of what we face, where we don't have, the one-time monies that have been available the last 8 years, that we'll have to be careful about what we cut, what we don't cut. I mean, I guess I think the last thing anybody around this table, irrespective of party, geography, whatever, would want to see is some federal judge, from the Minnesota District Bench enjoying the state of Minnesota from whatever we were trying to do. We'd all look pretty foolish in the process, and at best we'd look foolish. And that's why I think it'll be useful to try to have some of those distinctions. I don't want to belabor the hearing this morning, at least since I was late, in terms of going through every hypothetical. But I think it would be quite helpful that all of us have a better appreciation of what we can do or what we can't do in terms of, skirting, breaking the law, whatever. So let me leave it at that just because I think it's a complicated area.
I think Senator Hahn has been studying this issue fairly closely and getting a handle on it. It's not real encouraging news for us because it really does tie our hands in many regards. Senator Hahn.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, it makes a very good point, and I think we need to be clear on that. And I think it's one of the dangers that we should recognize when we accept the federal monies, which seem attractive to us to allow us to do things, but they really constrain your ability to manage going forward if you end up with a situation such as we have today where you've got to look at how you trim some of those costs, and it makes it very complex and in some cases very difficult. If you look at just eligibility, for example, as Mr. Albrecht pointed out, we are not permitted to reduce the eligibility levels of when people qualify, but other states have different eligibility levels than we do. Wisconsin, for example, has different eligibility levels. If we just mimicked Wisconsin, we would probably run afoul of federal constraints. Now, I'm thinking that we might want to, and to what extent it might be doable, I don't know, but pursue waivers, for example, to propose some things that on the face of it might be conflicting with the federal laws, but we might want to do that and hope that we could get some grace from the federal government to allow us to do some things that might otherwise be restricted. Otherwise, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to try to do this without, at this point, I don't have the answer, but the point is well taken.
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, certainly there have been attempts in the past to seek waivers, and you and Senator Berglund would be better able to discuss that than I could. Obviously, the difficulty with seeking a waiver is, far be it for me to suggest what it'll take to get through the federal Department of Human Services to get the waiver, and I don't know, does it come to the White House, and does it go down the block to the Capitol building? I mean, who knows? And obviously our problem is balancing a budget by May, whatever it is. So I'm not being dismissive of that, Senator Hahn, but it sounds to me like that's maybe more of a long-term goal for the state. And it sounds like, Senator Hahn, again, I've never served on the division, and it certainly sounds like you're on top of it, or as any of us can be trying to be on top of it. But this is such a tricky area of the budget, and Madam Chair, at the risk of, I think I'd reach the point where I said, well, back in the old days, or back when, that kind of thing, but back in the old days when I was chairman of the Finance Committee, I tried to get a handle on this thing because I'd never served on the division, and the complication is really significant. I just, by way of anecdote, I look at what happened in Arizona this past year, where they attempted, facing a lot of the same problems, to attempt to deal with the state eligibility where they had the legal ability to do so. And they eliminated the state. It got decent amount of national press. I don't know if everybody's read the stories about Arizona, but they eliminated the state transplant program. And so there were individuals, and I don't know how anecdotal it was, but that's a place where they could do so without running afoul of the federal maintenance law. And they had individuals, according to the news stories, that were scheduled for a transplant that got a call the day before saying, well, make sure when you come to the hospital for your transplant, you also bring $200,000 with you. And there were actually people who died because of Arizona's, I don't know how many, but at least a handful of people, I think, died because of the Arizona legislature's decision to eliminate their transplant part of human services. And now everybody in Arizona is just backing away 180 degrees to reinstate the program. So we sure want to be careful that when we adjourn, you know, we're not in the rush to balance the budget, that we, you know, aren't aware of exactly what we're doing. I mean, and I'd be optimistic that this Senate, I can't speak for the House, but this Senate is not going to act in, you know, to use the Arizona example, in such an expeditious way.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. I think we will be very cautious, as we have been becoming aware of the federal laws and have been advised on them. So it's something we will be taking into consideration as we move forward. Senator Goodwin had her hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I'm looking at this chart, I'm seeing continuing care grants. That's basically nursing home reimbursements and assisted living, that type of thing, I take it. And my question before I answer that is, how much of the MA money, how much of the money in this budget is for the elderly, I mean, including MA? So if we took, what percentage of this are we spending on the elderly of our entire budget? What, do you know what that percentage would be in total?
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, within the continuing care category, that $3.8 billion there is spending for elderly and disabled folks. I believe in other areas of the Department of Human Services, there is also spending for the same populations. And getting any precision on the exact dollar and the way those monies split out between the elderly population and the disabled population is difficult, but it is something that we continue to work with the department on trying to figure out.
So we don't, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Senator, I couldn't Goodwin. Give you, Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, I couldn't give you a precise dollar amount. I think it's in the area of about 40% of that money.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Mr. Albrecht, there's been so much talk about the early, you know, expansion, and I know that the population that we're going to be covering with this is the population that, for the most part, we were serving with other funds, for example, Minnesota Care or uncompensated care. Will you, in this presentation, and if you don't have it in this presentation, would you be willing to provide at least me, because I don't serve on that committee, with some of the details about where the money showed up before, how it relates, so that we can really see actual incremental cost? That's, I'm just curious if there is, in fact, an incremental cost or if, in fact, it's a wash.
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, I would be happy to provide additional information to you, but it sounds like maybe I should contact you and get a little more specific direction on what it is that you're looking to find out.
And Madam Chair, and
Senator Bonoff,
so would you have that answer? Just do you know whether or not there's an, I mean, if we looked at this slide, it would look like there would be an incremental cost to the state of $383 million, and I suspect that's not in fact the case. So I'm just wondering, do you know the incremental cost?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, actually, in this instance, I think when you're speaking of incremental cost, this is a representation of that amount because it is a net amount of all of the components of that contingent appropriation, one of which was repealing the GAMC program, which is where a lot of the population that would be moved into the MA program is currently being served and was served in the past.
Okay.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Albrecht, you can correct me, but I think Senator Bonhoff, as I understand what we're doing, and I think you're right, a lot of this expansion money is transferring folks that were in the MA or the Minnesota Care program over to this, and so there's sort of a wash. We offset it with health care access funds. But there is an additional component in that the new expansion provides for coverage to people who are non-residents, for example. Currently in law in Minnesota, you have to be a resident for, I think, 30 days before you qualify for some of the lower income health insurance plans, but in the expansion you would not. Also, there is an asset test that requires that you have low level of income and less than about $1,000 in assets, but the expansion eliminates the asset test, just requires low income. So the estimates that I saw, which I think are guesstimates, were something on the order of about 12,000 additional people who currently do not qualify for our low income insurance programs that would in the expansion structure. And so that would represent a net increase to our overall spending. And I don't know precisely what that dollar is, but it's a the estimate that's being used is about 12,000 additional people. And is that about correct, Mr. Albrecht? Does that ring any bells with you?
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, the 12,000 people is an estimate of folks who would come from a variety of sources. I'm not sure that it's that they are currently are not eligible. I think it's that they currently do not participate.
Thank you. We better move on.
Well, Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Anderson.
Just to make sure I understand that. So now when you're counting them, is that because you're assuming they'll participate for some reason? Why is that assumption made?
Mr. Albert.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I think it's a matter of increased awareness of the program. I think it is related to the fact that the benefit set is more generous in MA than it is in Minnesota Care. Partly it may be related to the GAMC program and the changes that were made in that program that have already led to a substantial increase in the Minnesota Care population. It's a number of factors like that.
Thank you. We have about 10 more slides and 15 minutes.
And Madam Chair and members, I wanted also to just point out to you one oversight on my part on this slide, and that is the amount of money that's shown there for state-operated services also includes, I believe it's $335 million for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program that probably should have been shown separately. And then I ask you also just to keep in mind this Children and Economic Assistance $1.1 billion, because there will be a later slide that gives you some additional detail about that next biggest piece of the pie. this is some additional information about the MA program because it's such a large proportion of the overall spending. And what I think is important for you to understand is to look at the proportions for elderly and disabled and families with children. This is showing you the number of average monthly recipients in the MA program. In any given month, there are about 773,000 people. 63% of them are in the category of families with children, and 24% of them are in the elderly and disabled category. That's what I'm saying. This slide shows you the spending on those groups. What's important to notice is that whereas the elderly and disabled were 25% of the people, they're 64% of the dollars. And similarly, where families and children category were 63% of the people, they're only 25% of the dollars. The Healthcare Access Fund is one of the larger funds in the in this division, or this committee, I should say. You will probably hear some discussion about the Healthcare Access Fund. It is primarily used to pay for the Minnesota Care Program. It receives its money through a 2% provider tax paid by medical providers, a 1% gross premium tax on insurance premiums, and some federal funding for administration. And this shows you the uses of the Healthcare Access Fund. You can see the largest use is the Minnesota Care Program. Related to the MA expansion up there in the upper left-hand corner shows that policy saves $415 million in the Healthcare Access Fund. And there's a small 3% of the money in that fund that is used to pay for Minnesota Care Administration. This is the basic criteria or description of the Minnesota Care Program. It's generally intended for folks who don't have access to affordable coverage. There are income and program guidelines. Individuals have to pay monthly premiums based on income. Most of the people are have an income below 150% of the federal poverty guidelines. Yesterday I was asked what that is, and I didn't know, but I double-checked overnight, and it's about $16,000 for one person, $16,000 per year. And there are about 118,000 people enrolled per month. That may be a little bit low because it's an I believe it's a fiscal year 2009 number, and everything we're hearing from the department is that there has been substantial growth in Minnesota Care, largely due to ending or changing the GAMC program and people migrating from what used to be the GAMC program into Minnesota Care.
Well, Mr. Albright, if they migrated in because they weren't using the current GAMC program, but now we're expecting them to migrate out to the early medical assistance, quite a few, right? So that growth should slow down significantly in Minnesota Care?
Madam Chair, I would think so, but I don't know all of the reasons for growth in Minnesota Care. There could be growth related to the changes in the economy as well, and that would be a population perhaps above 75% of the federal poverty guideline, which is who the GAMC and the MA expansion populations are.
Okay. Senator Bono?
Madam Chair, but I guess going back to when you showed that slide about the 415 that would come out of using the, that was where my question was coming from about the relationship between the 383 and that number.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, the way that the MA expansion was structured in the contingent appropriations, that the savings in the Healthcare Access Fund were used to pay for part of that program, and the $384 million in the general fund reflects transfers from the Healthcare Access Fund into the general fund.
Thank you.
Mr. Albright, just real quickly, what is the health of the Healthcare Access Fund? I've heard that it's expected to run out of money within a couple of years. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, with the MA expansion going forward, the projected balance in the Healthcare Access Fund at the end of fiscal year 2013 is a deficit of $155 million.
Even with the early MA, it's still projected to go to into deficit.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And Senator Goodwin.
To that point, Madam Chair, isn't that because we've used money out of the fund for the general fund to balance the budget?
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, there are some transfers between the Healthcare Access Fund and the General Fund. However, they only occur if there is a positive balance in the health care access fund?
Madam Chair, I remember when I was here as state representative, there was money taken out of the health care access fund to balance the state budget. So I'm talking about, you know, over the last several years, hasn't money been transferred directly into the general fund to help balance the budget? Senator Berglund would know more about this than I do, but I certainly remember that happening because I didn't like that idea. So.
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, I am relatively new to this committee.
Okay.
This is my second year working on this committee. but my understanding is that there have been transfers between the funds. There have been loans between the funds. But I don't recall, at least in recent history, you know, total rating of the healthcare access fund to balance the general fund.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, on the chart you have there, it's showing 1.7, is that just 1.7 million that's left? Or billion?
Billion.
Billion.
1.7 billion, and yet you expect, at what point will it be 100 million short? Could you tell me where's the leakage, or where is that going? Or is it not being collected? I mean, isn't this a 2% tax on every healthcare procedure that's done?
It's 1%.
Mr. Albert.
What would cause that big a shift in a relative short time of 1.7 billion to in the hole?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what this slide is showing you is where the funding for the Minnesota Care Program comes from. And yes, so $1.8 billion of funding for Minnesota Care comes out of the Health Care Access Fund. The reason that the Health Care Access Fund has a projected deficit is because the projections for participation in the program basically project that the number of people times the services that they use will exceed the revenue coming into the fund.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Yes, and Mr. Albrecht, and I think, and to Senator Olson, your question, also there's a component of the funding that comes from a tax on insurance, health insurance premiums of 1%, but that only is applied to people buying insurance in the private marketplace. So if you're insured by a corporation that's self-insured, that is not collected. So, and there's been a shift to try to, in many of the businesses, to shift out of being active in the private marketplace. And so as that goes away, there will be a reduction in the premium tax that is collected as well that may contribute to the weakening of the fund.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Senator's question, in the past, yes, we have transferred, the legislature has transferred large amounts from the healthcare access fund to the general fund to help balance. But in all fairness, when we were running surpluses, the legislature chose not to do the reverse. So that has, you know, there's plenty of blame to go all around on that one. My question on this slide, and I just want for clarity's sake, and I don't know if Senator Hand, you know, or when we talk about the, in 2013 when there is deficit, I'm unclear if this money will all be gone and essentially we would have the equivalent of a debt, or if it means that the cash flow is such that we are running a deficit in the cash flow. And to shorten that up, is the money going to be all gone, or is it just slowly dissipating? I was unclear on that.
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Nienau, I believe that the answer to your question is that there would be money out the door to pay for services in Minnesota Care, $150 million more without any changes to the program than there is in the fund.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. That was my understanding, but I was unclear in the discourse here if somehow that money was actually going to be gone, and we were actually going to run out of money in the healthcare access fund. My understanding was that it was we were running a deficit, and slowly our balance is going to be declining. If we don't fix that at some point, obviously, it will all be gone. But I wasn't aware that it was going to all disappear by 2013. I just wanted to make sure that that wasn't what I was hearing. So thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Nino, I think that is what you're hearing.
That is that is the case.
Yes.
Okay, so that I may have misunderstood what when I hear the term deficit, for example, if we have deficit spending, we're spending more than we're taking in, and so a $115 million deficit. So we will, for my sake, with the roughly 3% of health care that we have taking in the form of taxes, a 1% provider tax and 2% service tax or vice versa, whichever that is, with that money that's coming in, our incoming cash flow into the health care access fund, that will all be spent in addition to the fund balance of $1.8 billion. It will all be gone, plus another hundred and some million dollars. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, the $1.8 billion is the money that's coming in.
I'm sorry. Okay, Madam Chair, what is the current balance? Do you know?
Oh, no, I don't.
Okay.
Okay, let's go forward.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to clarify that
Anderson.
We don't deficit spend in Minnesota. I mean, if there's not enough money, then the bills won't get paid. It's not like it's going to come from somewhere else or there's going to be I assume there's no legal obligation to pay the bills. I think people just won't get service and it just won't, or they won't get reimbursed for services provided. So it's not that there will be deficit spending.
And I think what we need to focus on is that the program has to be changed in order not to run into that situation in 2013. We're going to have to make adjustments to the program. We need to finish here quickly.
And very quickly, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, there are provisions in law that direct the governor or the Commissioner of Human Services to take a number of actions if the legislature does not resolve the fact that there is a projected deficit in the health care access fund. And those things are things like stopping enrollment into Minnesota Care, or I believe they can limit the adjust the payments downward and such. I'm not sure what that entire range of options is. Very quickly, Madam Chair, this slide shows you that for that 10% or $1.1 billion of children and economic assistance programs, these are some of the more high-profile programs in that area. I wanted to give you a sense of their relative proportion to the overall budget and to the MA program in particular. So the MFIT program is about $176 million. The child care for that program or related to that program for MFIT is about $138 million. The basic sliding fee child care program is about $90 million. And you can see for some of the other programs that you may hear about or may have gotten questions about, their relative size compared to other areas in the budget. You all know, I'm sure, something about the TANF program, the federal program that in Minnesota is called MFIP, the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I think in the interest of time, what you we'll want to know is there are maybe about 37,000 average monthly families and about 100,000 people participating in that program. This slide shows you the various funding sources for that program. The almost half of the money comes from the federal fund in the form of assistance for food. And the other side of that graph, the general fund and the federal fund, are largely used to pay for cash assistance and other activities for those participants. Madam Chair, I could get through these other agencies in a minute or two, provided there are no questions. Do you want to continue?
I think we'll proceed and we'll just hold questions, and then if members decide that it's important to have some questions answered, they choose to stay late themselves.
Okay. This is just reiterating the other agencies in this budget committee. This is for the Department of Health showing all of the their all funds allocations. You can see at the very top there they have only $152 million coming from the general fund. And in the middle there they have a substantial $500 million that comes from the federal fund. The other agencies in the jurisdiction of the committee have relatively small general fund allocations. And also in the committee's jurisdiction are the health-related boards. There are 16 of them. This is a list of them and where they get their money from. And it continues on the next page. There's the rest of them. They are largely funded by the licensing fees that the individual practitioners pay to be licensed to practice in this state, and then the money that they pay for that is used to administer these boards. And I believe that is the end.
Okay. Are there any questions? Okay, if not, we plan to meet next Wednesday, and we will be taking up a big budget bill. And so we hope you can all be here with us. And otherwise, we will be adjourned for today.
That's going to be Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Is this the billion-dollar cut bill?
Correct.
And is it going through committees first before it comes here?
It's going to the tax committee on Tuesday.
But no budget committee, no other budget committees?
Correct.
Okay. Is that bill? It's been introduced?
That's a good question. Yeah.